served as an astronaut with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. From 1996 to 2014, he's a veteran of two NASA space flights, STS-109 aboard Space Shuttle Columbia in March 2002 and STS-125 aboard Space Shuttle Atlantis in May 2009. Graduate of Columbia University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Massimino currently lives in New York City. And joining him, I didn't even ask about the pronunciation of your last name, so I'm just going to go for it. Yeah. Babak Ferdowsi?
Yep.
Okay, sweet. Is an American systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL. He served on the Cassini-Huygens?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say that right? Cool. I'm two for two. And Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity missions. And he's also known on the interwebs as NASA's Mohawk guy. So we're really happy to have them both. And they're here to discuss Spaceman, an astronaut's unlikely journey to unlock the secrets of the universe, which Neil deGrasse Tyson says, every generation of astronauts needs a storyteller, a person with wit, humor, and passion who has lived our collective dreams of space exploration and returned to tell us all about it. He is that person. He's that astronaut, and this is his story. Thanks.
Well, first, I want to thank all of you for coming, and thank you very much to Babak for agreeing to do this and be in conversation with me. And I just asked him like a few days ago. So
yeah.
Thank you very much for being so flexible.
I'm excited because I got to ask you questions that
I feel like
I didn't get to ask you the last time.
Okay.
I hung out. Very personal, intimate questions.
Yes. Nothing to do with the book.
No, not at all. Oh. First of all, what do you think of this shirt? It has little rockets. I got a shuttle on there.
What are the other?
Oh, those other rockets. Saturn V.
What do you like? How do you like this shirt you've got? Where'd you get that shirt, by the way?
I got this at the Griffith Observatory.
Very nice.
Mike, a couple of things. First of all, for you guys, I met Mike 4 years ago at the inaugural parade, where we were both asked to walk.
Is that when we first?
Yeah.
No, wait a minute. I thought I met you at Rice before. That was in 2012.
Yeah.
Right? And then, is that when we first met?
I think that's where we first met.
When did the guy get elected again?
He got elected in 2012.
That was in 2012.
And then
so 2013.
January 2013 was the inauguration.
Right, but I think I remember I met
Rice?
You in October of 2012.
With Ravi.
With Ravi, you came at Rice. You
so
came
I
from Space
already got my first fact wrong.
When did you land that thing on Mars?
It was August 2012.
You know what Babak has done? Actually, I should interview you.
I think
he was part of the Mars rover landing, and it was August of 2012.
August 2012, yeah.
So you guys came to Houston as part of your post landing tour. I think it was October.
You are right. Yeah, we did.
It was October of 2012 because that's when I first met you and Ravi.
Right. At Rice.
And then we hung out in. Which was fun at
yes.
the inauguration.
We That's where the bromance really started.
That's it, yes. Yeah. That was really fun. Because they made us go there early. Didn't they make us go like 4 days ahead of time?
We got there super early.
Because they didn't want us to be late for the inauguration. So we got there really early. We were hanging out for like 4 or 5 days.
We even got to the inauguration early. It was like 5 hours of waiting.
Yeah, we were freezing. It's like the one day that's cold in Washington, D.C., everyone's freezing and make you stay outside. The other thing was where did we eat that in the
Ben's
night?
Ben's Smoke Shop.
About like 3 a.m.
Yes.
We ate chili somewhere in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it was Ben Smoke, which is like a sausage and chili place.
It was awesome.
And I tried to convince them they should serve you for free because they had a...
No, they didn't. Yeah,
they had a sign, though, that said only the president eats for free. And I was like, but this guy's been to space. And they were like, no.
No, they didn't care.
Yeah. Not as impressive.
No, where's your money?
Yeah.
That was good. That was a fun
time,
good.
Though. And so we've hung out since then.
Yes.
A couple of times.
Yeah.
You have a book out.
Yes, I do.
Yes,
that's why we're here.
It's here.
It's right there.
Yeah.
There it is, yep.
But I kind of want to know, Mike, what was your... So I remember my first moment was Pathfinder 97, seeing this little rover this big land on Mars.
Yeah.
What was your moment where you were like, all right, this is a thing that I want to
Well, for me, you know, I'm a bit older, and I can remember the moon landing and Neil Armstrong and Buzz walking on the moon. And I was 6 years old, almost seven, six going on seven. And that for me was the moment where I started dreaming about being an astronaut. And it was more than just dreaming about it. I think it was more like, this is the coolest thing happening, the most important thing happening. Every 6 year old kid wanted to be an astronaut back then, I think, but for me, it became a little bit more personal, serious. It really did affect me. It really did catch my imagination and never let go. But that was it for me.
Were you good at in school? Like, were you a pretty good student?
I was okay. Nothing spectacular. But I was okay. I went and talked at my elementary. Hello, my friends are showing up from all over. Bernie's here. I thought I saw her earlier. She's on the front. Oh, there. Hello, Bernie. How are you? Anyway, some friends here. Nice to see you. Thank you for coming. For me, when I went and visited my elementary school after I became an astronaut, I went back and visited, and they were very nice. They had like a little space day going on, and one of my teachers was still there. Mrs. Oko was my fourth grade teacher, and we had lunch set up, and they had invited her to have lunch with me because she was one of the teachers that was still there, and she said that she was having breakfast with her son that morning. And he said something like, "Oh," and she said, "No, I'm going to have lunch with one of my former students." And yeah, he's an astronaut now. And then the kid said, "Oh, he must have been really smart, right?" And she said, "I don't know." She said, "He must have been bright, but if he was really smart, I think I would have remembered, you know." And so I wasn't the smartest kid in Mrs. Oko's class. I was a good student. I guess I was curious. I liked math and science, and I worked pretty hard. So I was a decent student, but it wasn't natural for me to be a good student. I had to work hard at it. But I did like math a lot. To me it was like solving puzzles. It was like fun homework was the math homework. And I also I liked physics when I got to high school. I remember being at basketball practice one afternoon in 11th grade and thinking, "Oh, cool, I get to go home and do some physics homework after this." And I don't remember really thinking that much about homework, but I remember thinking that about physics. I really liked it. And so to me that was an indication that, science and math were things that I liked, and engineering was a good thing for me to pursue when I got to college.
And you went to industrial engineering.
I went to industrial engineering.
Which is not what most people think of for space.
No, what happened to me was... When I had that dream when I was little about becoming an astronaut, that was something that I wanted to do. But right at about maybe like age 8 or 9, it went into the realm of impossible. Mm-hmm. And I think it was I was an awkward kid. I didn't see very well. I was nearsighted. I was skinny. I got cold when I went in the water. I was afraid of heights. I didn't like going very
motion
fast.
Motion sick? Did you get motion sick?
No, because I never had any motion. I used to stand still most of the time. Now I am. I think it's the phone that does it to me in the car. Mm-hmm. That's when I get trying to do that. Usually provokes a little bit of nausea, just so you know. But I think what it was is after about age 8 or 9, it became, I thought it was impossible. And it would have been impossible for me at that time, too, because the astronauts back then primarily were military test pilots and shorter people. They were, I think the height limit for the original Mercury astronauts was like 5'9 or so. And then as it had expanded, I think up to 5'11 for Apollo, but still was, I'm 6'3". So, but it was different. It wasn't until the shuttle program came into being where it opened it up to lots of people from science and math, not just the military test pilots, and people of different shapes and sizes and ethnic backgrounds, people of color and women, and that was when the shuttle program came in. So when I looked into it later, I looked into what astronauts were like in the 80s when I was at a college and thinking that I would really love to maybe become one. It was possible. It wasn't just I didn't have to go and become a military test pilot. So it was, there was a chance, I thought. But the interesting thing about this industrial engineering was that I wasn't thinking about becoming an astronaut or even working for NASA when I was in college. When I went to college, I just was interested in getting an education. And when I picked out my major, the advice I got was to look at the courses I thought were interesting. And that's what I did. And there was some courses in industrial engineering at Columbia which were about human factors and how humans relate with machines. And I thought that that was really interesting. It had some other standard kind of engineering stuff. It had some more in the economics, finance side for engineering than other engineerings. But it had the basic stuff, and then it had this human factor stuff, which I thought was interesting. And I decided to study industrial engineering. And I think that was a good choice for me. When I got out of college and I started thinking about, and I was working as an engineer at IBM, and I started to think, what do I want to do? Do I want to continue with this path, or do I want to do something else? And really what it was, I wasn't really thinking that way. What happened is I realized that I still was interested in the space program. And when I was looking at astronaut biographies, back then, now you can look online at the astronauts, but back then you had to write away to NASA, and they would send you a stack of paper, and you had to go through it. You know, it's different. But they sent them to me, and I was looking through those, when I was after undergrad, and there was not one industrial engineering major who became an astronaut. But what was good was that I didn't base my decision to become an industrial engineer on that. I did it because I thought it was interesting. And the advice I give to young people or anyone who's interested trying to pick out a major to do something, I think you really need to do what you love and what you like and not pick it out because I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. You never know what path is going to take you. If you follow what you like, it'll take you on the right path. So when I went to grad school, I ended up studying mechanical engineering, but as an undergrad, it was industrial engineering, and that was the right choice for me. And if I would have done something because I thought, well, if I become this type of engineer, it'll give me a better chance of becoming an astronaut, that would have been a mistake. So I'm actually kind of grateful I wasn't making decisions based on trying to fly in space someday.
That's a good point. So I just learned very recently that there is a job at JPL that is a seamstress who sews the insulating blankets that we put on our spacecraft together. She did not think that she was going to work at NASA one day as a seamstress.
Yeah,
but it's kind of amazing. Like she liked sewing things, but then realized this is actually there is a job for that. So I think that's totally to your point.
Exactly.
It's very roundabout. People end up in very weird ways doing a career that they love, but also pursuing the activity that they really are passionate about.
I think it's two different things. It's what you love doing, and then the world you want to live in. Right. So I mean, if you want to work at NASA, but you aren't inclined to want to study engineering, there's a million other things you can do at NASA. If you want to be involved with professional baseball, and you can't hit a fastball like me, I can't hit. I could, that eliminated.
Like most of the Mets.
Been decent year this year, but. But there are other things you can, even really smart engineers, the math people now are involved in baseball with all these cybermetrics. I mean, there's always a way to get involved with something you love based on something you enjoy doing, even if you might not be what you would think of first as something. The lady that does the sewing, does she use a sewing machine?
One of those,
They have a lot of seamstresses that work.
She used to work in
Playtex. Spacesuits. Did she really?
This opened up a world of possibilities.
No, there's a. You mentioned about the seamstress thing, but there's on our spacesuits that we spacewalk in. There's the plant where they're made down at in Dover, Delaware. There's two places they're made. The hard goods, the helmet, the upper torso, which is a hard upper torso, the pliss, the life support system. That's all Hamilton Sunstrand in Connecticut, Windsor Locks, Connecticut. But the soft goods, what we call soft goods, which means your gloves, your arms, the pants, those are like soft material, similar to the thermal blankets.
Right.
I don't know if they have micrometeorite protection inside of those things. Plus, we have a bladder to keep you under pressure so you don't die. So they have that in there. But they work on these sewing machines. There's an army of people sewing these machines. And they use these old Singer sewing machines that they don't make anymore. So they need parts for them, so they stockpile them. So if you're ever down there, if you can get in there and ask for a tour, you go into one of these gigantic storerooms, the room maybe the size of this, with these old Singer sewing machines that they keep around for parts because they can't buy them anymore, the old style. But they were these industrial grades with these gigantic needles, I guess, that could actually thread through the material.
That and, like, the Joy
The Joy soap is another thing. Yeah, we put... We on our visor, we have a tradition. I talk about it in the book, where we have a tradition where we coat our visor with an anti-fog. So any of you have done any scuba diving, for example, you want to coat your visor so you don't fog up. And so we would do that with this anti-fog, which was a soap. It was Joy soap, and they stopped making it. So NASA panicked because this was a special kind of Joy soap they needed. They didn't want to have to go through the cost of certifying another type of anti-fog.
Sure.
So they're like, no, we need. So they bought like a million years worth of supply of this stuff. So they have these giant vats of this Joy soap that they still use. So, but yeah, that was the interest I had as a little kid, and then getting older, I thought it was just impossible to do this. And the first few chapters of the book talk about this, that it really just seemed very unlikely. And where I was, where I grew up, I tried to describe my neighbors, a great place to grow up, but it was kind of like more like a blue collar. Not many, my parents didn't go to college, most parents didn't in my neighborhood. And if you went to college, you were going to get a job and hopefully have a happy life. Was the idea, but the idea of becoming an astronaut was never anything I would ever dream of seriously doing. And then when I got out of college, I was like, well, why not? Someone has to work in the space program. Maybe I can't become an astronaut, but why not give it a try? And that's when I started to take those steps. I went to grad school and took those steps to try to see if I could make it happen.
So you applied more than once.
I did. I applied. I was rejected three times. I applied the first time. I applied once I was at MIT, and I got my master's degree. I met the minimum qualifications to be astronaut, right? And so I sent in the application, and I waited for a few months, and then NASA sent me a very polite letter saying no after that, right? And so then I waited. I kept going to school. I was still at MIT, going to grad school. And a few years later, they said they were looking for astronauts again, and I put in a second application, and then they sent me back another letter saying no a second time. So it was 0-2. So then the third time I was working down at the Johnson Space Center, and I had some more experience. I'd gotten my PhD, and they said they were looking for astronauts, but the third time, a few years later now, and this time they said come in for an interview. And so I went in for the interview, and they got to know me really well, and then they told me no. But one of the things they got to know about me is that I couldn't see very well. And I talk about this in the book, that before they could tell me no just because of no, I was disqualified. I was medically disqualified for my eyesight. And now they accept things like LASIK and maybe something else, but I know they do accept LASIK if you're stable and the operation goes well and you can see better, that's okay. They also, there really is no reason, I don't think even to have that, unless you're really nearsighted, because they've expanded what you could see. As long as you're correctable at 20/20, right. I think they're good with it. If anyone's interested here, look up the NASA regulations. They change all the time anyway. So what I'm telling you is, I'm not making it up totally, but it's outdated. So if you're interested in applying, you should look at what the regs are. But at the time, you had to see 2150 unaided, and I was more like 2350, 2400. So I was just disqualified, and there was no procedure that was acceptable that they would allow you to do, and then accept it. And if you did any of those things, like they had radiokeratotomy and something else, if you did that, you were done for life. So what I was faced with this dilemma that I just couldn't read the eye chart well enough. So I looked into being desperate, and even if I could get this corrected, it didn't mean that I'd get picked, and it was only mean they could consider me again. So, but to even get back into the hunt, I needed to see better. So I, being desperate as I was, the only way you could improve your vision without getting a surgical procedure was to somehow miraculously be able to see better. So that's what I needed. I needed a miracle. And I found out about vision training. And there was a book I got. It was called Seeing Without Glasses. I got this book. It was hard to find these kind of books. There was no internet really working out well back then. It was just 20 years ago. But somehow I found this book. And I found a doctor, Desiree Hopping in Houston, that had worked with kids, because sometimes they can improve kids' vision, but usually it's like little kids while their eyes are still developing or whatever. So it's like, I was kind of a big kid. So she says, all right, we'll give it a try. And she did, and I was able to do these exercises and get myself so I could see better and somehow stumble through the NASA eye exam another time, and it was on that fourth try I was able to apply again, and then at fourth try I went in for the interview and got picked. So
what goes through your mind when they say, welcome to the astronaut candidate class of 1996?
Disbelief, I think, is what my reaction was. And yeah, I remember getting that phone call, and I described this in a book, but I get that phone call, and I get on the phone Dave Leitzma, who was a former astronaut, still with NASA, but he had a managerial position. He was the head of flight crew operations, and he says, and I knew these calls were coming that day, and word got out. The rumor mill was that these calls were coming, good or bad, on this Monday morning, and it was in April of 96, and I get on the phone, and he goes, hi, Mike, this is Dave Leitzma from the Johnson Space Center. How are you doing today? And I knew what he was calling about. So I said, I don't know how I'm doing, Dave. You're going to have to tell me. And he said, I think you're doing pretty good, because we want to make you an astronaut, and we're hoping you're still interested. And I was like, yes, I'm still interested, absolutely. And it's disbelief, really, is what it is. It was, especially after trying so hard and not getting there, and it seemed so impossible that it could happen, particularly with just everything. I mean, I describe it where, the failure, getting knocked down and not doing well, having bad semesters and recovering, failing my doctoral exam at MIT, and then getting medically disqualified. I mean, all these things just seemed to get in the way, and just was just more hurdles to get over. And then finally getting that phone call, and it's like, you're in.
It's pretty awesome.
It was great. Yeah, it was great.
So we skip over like 5 years of training at this point, mm-hmm. and now you are getting ready for your first launch. Mm-hmm. It's on Columbia.
Yes. Yeah.
What goes through your mind in a countdown? And it's hours of countdown.
It's hours of countdown. You're sitting there, and you're there for a while, and you weren't not really sure you're going to go that day. Okay. And Jim Newman, who was my spacewalking buddy, had flown three other times. This was his fourth mission, and his first to Hubble, but his third mission on the space shuttle. And each one of his missions had been delayed. When they went out to the launch pad, and for one reason or another, they didn't launch those days. They had the countdown go down, blah, blah, blah. And then, for whatever something happened. One time, I think, had an engine shut down at the last minute, and they scrubbed the launch and got everybody out of there. But each time, all three times, he did not go the day that he was supposed to go. So he said, Mike, don't think we're going anywhere today. I'm a jinx. So I was like, really? He goes, yeah, don't get your hopes up. We're going to be out there, and we're going to come back for lunch, and we're going to go another day, because I'm a jinx. So I was like, okay. And I was kind of counting on this being the case. So I said, it is a nice dress rehearsal. So we're laying on our backs out there, and I'm looking at him. I go, when are we going to go? He goes, don't worry about it. We're not going anywhere. And we got like about a couple hours left. I'm like, it looks like we're going. Everything's going smoothly. He goes, believe me, something's going to happen. And then we get down like to a couple minutes, and I go, Newman, I was expecting to go back to the crew quarters and have lunch. What's going on here? And he's like, I don't know, we might go. Like, what do you mean we might go? You told me we weren't going anywhere today. I was counting on that. And now, now I got to worry about getting launched into space. And that was probably a good thing for him to tell me, because I wasn't, thinking we were actually going to go that day until the last few minutes. And then sure enough, the engines light, the main engine start at 6 seconds, and the whole stack lurches forward and then comes back. And then at zero, because start at 6, they start their main, the liquid-fueled engines. Make sure they're running well. And then they do that for 6 seconds, and at 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, the solid rockets light, and then you start moving.
I saw Space Camp, so I...
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's the way they did in Space Camp?
Yeah.
I probably should have watched that before my flight. When did that movie... Did it come out? It came
86.
Out a while ago, didn't it?
It came out in 86.
86? Yeah. Okay, I should have watched that in preparation, but I didn't.
I always dreamed as like a kid I would go to Space Camp, and then
did you ever go?
Accidentally. I did go to Space Camp.
Did they?
But I did not accidentally get launched into space.
They lied to you in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little misleading.
So they accidentally launched these kids into space.
Well, kind of. A robot intervenes
kids in a real Jinx, space shuttle, yeah. Because the mock-up wasn't available.
They were like, you get a special treat today at space camp. You get to go on the real space shuttle.
Really?
To test it out.
To test it out. And next thing you know, they're in space. Right. And they saved the world, apparently, I'm sure.
Well, no, they mostly have to save themselves. They need more oxygen, and they go to the non-existent space station to get oxygen.
And it worked?
Yeah. No, it worked. Right. They didn't all die in space. It would be terrible.
They all came back.
They all came back.
It was a good movie. I mean, it was a happy ending.
Happy ending.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that.
Just like that.
Yeah, just like
that. So, like, you're, I mean, your first time, you obviously, you're just accept, but you know you're going to go back to space, you know, in a future, or you're hopeful
you're
that
hoping,
you go, you're hoping,
yes.
Right? Because there's a lot of astronauts who all want to go to space.
Right.
You're not alone. But then you get another chance to go, this time on Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
and it's for Hubble.
Yep.
What's, like, that's an EVA. So,
yes.
First of all, what's an EVA?
An EVA is a spacewalk. EVA stands for extravehicular activity, which means extravehicular meaning being outside of the vehicle as opposed to intravehicular, which is IVA. So being EVA, you're outside of the spacecraft, and it's a fancy way of saying spacewalk.
And that was your first time?
Both my times, yeah. I got to do spacewalks on both of those missions.
Okay.
Yep.
What's the sensation?
It is probably, I think, the way it struck me was, this is the coolest thing people can do.
Yeah.
It really is the most unique, coolest thing you can do. It's get outside the spaceship in your own spacesuit and move around and see what it's like out there. It's fun because you get to work on whatever it is you're working on. In this case, it was Hubble. And hey, Murray. You get to work on whatever it is you're going to work on, and that's very gratifying because it's fun training for it and working on tools, and then you're actually doing it out there in your spacesuit. But it's the most compelling thing is the view around you, the environment you're in, and it's just, you know, it's just you're out there, and you know you're in a different place. You know, even though you've been in space, you're in space for 3 days before you started the spacewalk. Spacewalk started on day four in space. And mine, I spacewalked on the second day of spacewalking, so it was day five. So I'd already been in space for, you know, four days and kind of gotten used to it and what it was like to live there and sleep and use the potty and eat and, you know, all that sort of looking and float around. And so you kind of start getting your space legs by that point. But it was a much different experience going outside. It was kind of like looking outside, looking into an aquarium, but it's kind of looking through the window of the shuttle. And then going outside is now you're a scuba diver where you're interacting with that environment. And things are just different. You know, you do get a chamber run, which means you go into a vacuum chamber with your real equipment to prepare you to go for your flight. And so you get a chance to see what it's like to maneuver around in your suit. You get to do little experiments, like you take a feather and a rock and drop them, and they both land at the same time. They give you a little cup of water in there, and you see it like crystallize and boil and whoop, and then it disappears. And you also you get to hear what your voice sounds like at that lower pressure, where you feel like you're ready to cut a blues album. You know, your voice gets really low. You can't whistle because there's not enough molecules of air to vibrate, so you can't whistle. You try and you can't. Little things like that. So you have that little experience. And at least you've done that. But that's when you get out, you get inside out in space, and you know, you can't hear anything except what's coming over the comm, and you have if your friends are talking to you over your headset, and you can hear your internal breathing, and you hear this fan noise of the suit, which is good because you know the suit is working. That fan stops, you know you're in trouble, right? So as long as that fan is going, you know you're okay. The suit's working. But it's kind of eerily quiet and in some ways peaceful, and your voice sounds different, and that's like what's going on inside of your spacesuit, you know, and then you're doing your work, moving around, but the atmosphere, the environment around you is so different. The sunlight was amazing. The first thing I noticed was how bright everything was, and I describe this in a book, but the sunlight in space, it comes through light coming through our atmosphere. Is distorted, just like the light from the stars is distorted to Earth-based telescopes, and that's why Hubble is so great, because it's above the atmosphere.
Right.
Can look directly in and make these great discoveries. And for, you know, for us being out there, the sunlight, even coming, you're above the atmosphere in your spaceship, but even the sun coming through the windows is filtered a bit. It's not the same as when you get outside. Now you just have your visor in front of you, and the brightness of everything was so bright. It was like this pure white. It wasn't even like light. It was like just this purity of light. It didn't seem like it was sunlight anymore. And everything was rich and crisp. All the colors, I remember looking at the American flag that I had on my left shoulder, and the color was so vibrant. Everything was so clear. I could see a lot. But I wish I could take my eye exam there, because it was just, everything was clear. And And then when you go into the darkness, because you go 90 minutes is an orbit, so it's 45 more or less of light, 45 of darkness. And as you go into the dark, so it's 16 sunrises, 16 sunsets in a 24-hour period. So it's just changing periodically of night and day. And then you go into the darkness, and it's devoid of light. It's like the blackest black. It's like the light is all gone. So that's what. That's what that was, and in the you know, that was my first impressions of the light, and then the view of the planet. You can see the curve of the planet from the altitude we were at Hubble. It's 100 miles higher than where the station is, and you can see that curve. It's amazing. You know, it's nothing like we've seen. The closest thing to it is the IMAX movies that we made. Some of my IMAX friends are here. And you can see that on a big screen, and but it's you have this planet. It's just so compelling to look at, and the thoughts that I had. I described this in a book, but it was this would be the view from heaven, seeing the planet. That's how beautiful it is. And then I was looking at that with that thought in my head, and it was like, no, it's not right. It's more beautiful than that. This is what heaven must look like. And that's what I think of our Earth now. I think of it as a paradise. There's bad things going on here all the time that we find out about happening, but it really, really, I truly believe it's a paradise. It's just perfect.
I couldn't agree. I mean, people ask if I want to go to Mars, and I'm mm-hmm. like, no, this is an amazing planet.
Yeah,
why would I want to leave?
Yeah. People say, what's my favorite planet? Earth.
Yeah.
My favorite, yeah.
Does your mind play tricks on you? I mean, being in microgravity, just all of a sudden being free floating in space, do you feel like, are there moments where you have to kind of, think your way out of a situation, like a sense of falling to the ground?
I didn't have any of that going on. No, I didn't have any like sense of, I felt amazingly good.
Yeah.
Like I was ready, like to be freaked out or not able to, but I was trained really well. And, so I knew my way around the space shuttle. I knew my way around the telescope. I knew the spacesuit really well. The view was completely different than anything I had experienced, of course, around me. But I felt all right, and I didn't, I felt like we knew what we were doing and working together as a team, and we had practiced so much and trained so much. I mean, the thought of doing something like that, like people think about, oh, I could never do, yeah, and I could have never done it either unless I practiced, it's just the stuff that you do as an astronaut is beyond anything you would think you could ever do, and that's because you take these baby steps. On step by step. The first time you go into a spacesuit, you do it on a test stand and you move around and see how it fits. And then before you do even a practice spacewalk, you have a suit qual. They call it a suit qual. It's a spacesuit familiarity session. And you go into the water and just see how your suit fits and move around a little bit. And then you get a run with a veteran where you go in, and I've done this as the veteran for a bunch of new spacewalkers as well, and someone else shows you the ropes. So you take these baby steps, and then you move on more and more, and the next thing you know, you're working with a buddy, and you're working together to do a typical spacewalk and train that way, and then you eventually get assigned to a flight and do specific training. So you take these steps, step by step, and by the time I was out there working, I mean, I was pretty overwhelmed by what I was going to do, and I was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? But it all went okay. I was really trained to do the work, but you're not trained to see the beauty around you. That's just overwhelming.
So I have one last question, because we're going to open it for Q&A, which is, so you were famous at NASA for saying, and when everything is great, everything is nominal.
Yeah.
Like, it does not matter how good it is, it's just nominal. Mm-hmm. But your Hubble repair was off nominal.
Yes.
What happened?
So the chance, the opportunity to be an astronaut was great. The opportunity to go on a space flight was, that's great too, to do that. But particularly to go with Hubble was more than I would ever have dreamed of happening to me for a number of reasons. One is that it's really cool from the astronaut perspective to go there. It's a higher altitude. You can see the roundness of the planet, and it's a lot of spacewalking. So it's a very well-defined mission. There's not really any there's no secondary payloads. Not much else going on except go up there and spacewalk. Make sure the telescope's good, and then let it go and come home. That was pretty much it. And so your training is a lot of spacewalk training, which is fun. It's challenging. It beats you up a bit physically and mentally as well. But it's just an extraordinary thing to do. So it's a really cool assignment to get as an astronaut. But also to be a part of that team, you know, the science world. Well, you're at JPL, and you got, you know, you work all these great scientists, you and the other folks you work with, doing these wonderful things. And to be a part of the telescope team, where I think Hubble is the greatest scientific instrument ever created. I mean, I don't know, maybe you could argue.
I mean, no, totally. I mean, it's absolutely changed our understanding.
It just came up. We were talking earlier about the water on Europa. That's more evidence of water on Europa.
Right.
That was just discovered a couple weeks ago by Hubble.
Right.
Right. And more recently, that there's more galaxies, 10 times as many galaxies as we thought, based on Hubble data. So it keeps showing us new stuff. It's just a magnificent instrument. So to get a chance to be involved with that was just great to be part of that team. And the off-nominal stuff that happened is always something that goes wrong in a spacewalk. Every time you train a spacewalk, you try to think of all the things that can go wrong when you first start. And then you come up with a checklist of things. We call it a crib sheet, which is where when something goes wrong, you go to the crib sheet. Oh, we can't turn this bolt, or this is stuck, or this broke, or whatever it is. And you add it to the crib sheet. And every time you do a spacewalk in the water, and we train in a water tank, a big tank at the Johnson Space Center. It's 100 feet wide, 200 feet long, and 40 feet deep. And we do that because if you think, it's an enormous pool. So if this, say for example, this is a much smaller room than the pool, but if we were filled with water here, and we had life support so we're not drowning, there would be a certain weight that we would have that would push us down because we have weight to us. But there's also the buoyancy of the water that pushes us up. And so by working weight and flotation, you can get a space in the water column where you're kind of floating like you are during a spacewalk. So that's why we train in the water. And when we would find something wrong in the water when we were doing our spacewalks, we would write that down and we'd be prepared to handle it in space. But something always goes wrong on a spacewalk. Sometimes it's a little thing, sometimes it's a bigger thing. What happened to me was we were trying to repair an instrument that was never intended to be repaired. Normally what we do is take a whole instrument out, like the wide field camera that came out of JPL, take that thing out, put a whole new wide field in. We had this one instrument, the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, a spectrograph about the size of a refrigerator or a phone booth that had a power supply failure. We did not have a full replacement for it, so we had to take it apart, which involved taking out an access panel that had 111 small screws in it, and we couldn't lose anything, and the screws each had washers, and then there was staking glue on all these threads, so this thing was never supposed to come out. So we developed a capture plate to capture all that stuff, and then a way to get it off, and then another way to take off the launch bolts, which describe what they're supposed to do is keep the thing in there for a launch. So no one's again, not ever supposed to come out, but we had to figure out a way to get these launch bolts out to remove this computer. It looked like a computer board. It was a power supply. Remove that and put a new one in. It had a 120-pin connector with these small pins that all had to be seated perfectly. And you're doing this inside the telescope where your lighting's not good, you can't see so well, and you're working with your gloves, which is like trying to do this with boxing gloves on. So we spent a lot of time on the intricate part of it, and the one part that we didn't spend that much time on was on a handrail that needed to be removed in order to access that panel. And that handrail was used for handling the instrument when it was put in as a replacement years earlier. And then it failed with this power supply, and now we're going to take the thing apart. And I stripped the screw on the bottom of that handrail. The three out of the four screws came out fine, but I stripped the screw on the bottom, and I realized that we didn't have a backup for that because we thought this was easy. This is like the most easiest thing we were going to do, and I messed it up. And so that was kind of bad. And I went quickly from the handrail's not coming off, the panel's not coming out, power supply's not getting replaced, we'll never find out if there's life on other planets, and everyone's going to blame me. You would never talk to me again, would you?
Probably not,
A good JPLer, you would be like the man who destroyed Hubble. No one's coming to that book signing, okay? So I felt really terrible about it. But a solution was thought of, which was really simple when you look at it. But an engineer on the ground thought about what he would do if he was in his garage, and he said, I would just rip it off And he said, well, let's see if Mike can do that. And that's what they did. They came up with a plan for me to just yank the thing, and I was able to tear it off.
Yeah.
And that seems like a very simple solution, but it's only simple after you hear about it. I don't know if I ever would have thought of it.
You're the only person I know of who has physically ripped off a part of a spacecraft.
I am. Though. That is my legacy. Yes, I repaired the Hubble by breaking it. That is my legacy. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we should open up to Q&A. I have many more questions, but I'm going to go with the audience. Yeah, come. By the way, just as a quick side note, questions should be in the form of a question. Sometimes people go for like a four-minute explanation. Just the question. Yeah, so go ahead. Just speak loudly.
Two. Is the water salt in the tanks? The practice tank?
No, it's chlorinated.
Chlorinated?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really heavy chlorine. Okay. It's kept fairly comfortable. A little on the cool side, but yeah. Yep.
The fourth call that you got.
Yeah. The good call.
You get the answer.
Yeah.
If it was a bad call, would you have tried for the fifth
call? Oh, yeah. I keep trying until now.
Yeah.
I don't think I never would have stopped trying. I'm pretty convinced of that. That would have never.
By attrition.
I would have just kept doing it. I think I could live with, I could live with them telling me. I really do think I could have lived a happy life if they kept telling me no. Because it was, you know, things are just beyond your control. The only thing I could control was to continue to apply. And I couldn't control I knew that it was unlikely that I would ever get picked. Even if when I got around the vision thing, now it was just like, okay, now I'm still one out of a million here. But as opposed to being zero. But I would have kept trying, and no doubt in my mind. I don't know if I ever would have gotten picked. But I would have kept trying.
What's your face when you were in for that eye exam where the girl was giving you a hard time?
Yeah, she read the book. Yeah.
What's your face? That?
Oh, the face. Yeah, so I described. So you said the question was, what was my face? I had this expression. What I would do is to try to see through this. The training exercise I was doing was kind of like to have you try to focus beyond what you were looking at. And sometimes your eyes actually would try to over-focus on something, and they're working a little bit too hard. So you're trying to make your eyes relax, believe it or not. And what you're trying to do is see beyond. Like, I'm looking at a poster there above this young lady's head. It says, an early taste of death is not necessarily... I don't know about that. I don't like that idea. Okay. All right, that one over there says to the moon, okay? And I like that one better. So I'm going to look at to the moon. And say I couldn't get that into focus. There's some smaller writing underneath it. What I would try to do is focus beyond it. So if you're looking here, your eyes focus and read this here. If I kept that same focus, this is going to get out of focus, and then I have to refocus. So the idea is you're trying to focus beyond what you're looking at. Sounds nutty, but if you can try to train your eye, I don't know where this was anyway. So if you can try to train your eye to do that. The image that you're looking beyond actually starts to come into view. This is what the thing was. But to answer your question, I had this like crazy stare that I would do, and it was, I haven't done it since that eye exam. But I was like, I'm done. But it was something like that. I would leave my eyes would be wide open to let as much eye, and I would try and look past this thing. And that was this crazy stare I would do during my eye exam. That one of the young, it was a student who was administering the test, didn't like. She thought I was cheating, and she thought I needed to relax my eyes. I am relaxing. She goes, no, you're not. She goes, relax your eyes. And I'm like, go away. You know, I've been through too much to have some optometry student give me trouble here. So.
Failed you, that would have been it.
If she had family, it would have been it. But luckily, there was a real eye doctor there who was like, okay, why are we having a fight in the examination room? You know, what's going on? So, but he stepped in and said, okay, let's just take a step back here and see what's going on. And yeah, I was able to get through it. But yeah, that was the look. It was this kind of staring kind of thing that probably frightened the poor young lady. So,
yeah.
Do they say no to everybody like that? And what are they looking for? I mean, you're an Ivy leader. What are they looking for? What are they saying yes to? How it beats you up physically and mentally to be in space. I can't even imagine how it would beat you up.
All right, so what was the first question again? What are they looking for? Well, they're saying,
Are they saying no to everybody?
Well, they say no to most people. I mean, So in my the selections I were in, back then they were getting about 5,000 applications or so, and picking anywhere between 12 and the class I was in was the largest. It was 35 Americans and 9 internationals. So 35 Americans is the most they've ever picked. This most recent class they had about. The class that they picked in 2013, 4 years ago, is the last time they picked. They have 8 people, 4 men, 4 women, 50-50. They picked 8 out of like 6,800 applications,
yeah,
something like that.
Somewhere shy of 10,000.
They're all PhDs.
And this,
they're
this
all, no, they're not all, but a lot of them are.
Yeah,
but the more recent they have now, they almost, my friends were going out of their minds because now I think, they have some people still want to be astronauts. Is there still an interest? They had 18,000 applications come in. They're not set up to handle that many applications because each one of those things gets read by 3 different people. We'd read every application. Some of them get screened out. I'm not sure how many got screened. They get screened out by HR if you don't have the right degree, if you don't have enough experience. The people that aren't, if you're not minimally qualified, if some high school kid sends in an application, they're like, no, we know you're really smart, but no, you're not. You got to go to college at least and get some experience and so on. So I don't know how many of those 18,000 fell into that category, but probably a good chunk, but most of those will make it to the astronaut office and you start reviewing them. As far as what they're looking for, this is where it starts getting a little bit interesting because at some point, everyone can look pretty good on paper. And the reason they have these interviews, they have different levels. So first you have to be minimally qualified. Most of those people, probably 80 to 90% of the applications are minimally qualified. And then they look for a group that we call highly qualified. And you're trying to go through these, have 3 people read them. They usually have 2 astronauts and then an adult. In there, like an adult supervisor. That's what they did. It was like, we would be like, I had one guy, I was looking at one application, this one guy had a ceramic hippopotamus collection, and I really wanted to meet this guy. There was another person who was an Etch-a-Sketch champion, and I was like, well, this would be really cool, right? I want to meet them. And we had a guy from deputy director of the Marshall Space Flight, and I was like, no, I mean, is there anything else besides the Etch-a-Sketch? And I was like, what else do you need? And it's like, you can't, like, so they always have like astronauts and an adult to keep us under control. And you're looking for the top 10% of the, more or less. And you'll go out and get references on those people. And then the references come in, and then you pick about 120 people over a course of time that you want to interview. So this is how this is the gates that you have to get through. And the interviewees are finalists. And then they pick from those, they'll pick however many they need. So what you're looking for is you're kind of trying to figure out who this person is. If this person might have a PhD or might be a medical doctor or they might not, but they have some really good work experience. Someone at the Jet Propulsion Lab, right away you see someone in JPL, oh, let's take a look at this person, or someone who's done well, whatever they're doing. And then you're trying to look for a little bit more, which is like, who is this person? What are they like? Are they going to be a good teammate? You could be the smartest person in the world, but you're a pain in the neck. Do you want that person around you? No. Right? Do you want that person around you in space? No. Right? So you want someone that you can trust. Someone that's going to, that you can trust with your life while you're training, to trust with your family while you're away, to take care of things if something bad happens. That's the kind of person you're looking for, someone that can really get along with people and be a real good team player. And that's where it starts getting difficult. And that's why we have the interview week. It was a whole week of time you spent at the Johnson Space Center because they want to get to know you, and they'll do due diligence in finding out who you really are. And that's what they're looking for.
And how does that affect you physically and mentally? You say it's hard on your body?
Well, your body goes through changes. I think you got beat up. The first time I did a spacewalk in the pool, a practice spacewalk, I'd never done any boxing in my life, but I felt like I'd been in a boxing match. I just got beat up really badly because you're working against the suit. And especially when you first start in there, you're moving around so much, it's unneeded in motion and you're not smart about it. And you're just all over the place and you're fighting all the time and trying to overpower things, and you just knock yourself out and you quickly get out of gas. But when you get to know what you're doing, you have a different technique and you move around. So the more experience you get, the easier it is, right? But at first you just get beat up. And there's things that happen to you in space because of being in zero gravity, like your spine elongates. You grow an inch and a half in your spine in space. No, you lose that when you come home. Yeah, no, it's an effect. It's only a temporary effect. You can't keep going and then go play in the NBA. It's not going to work. You got, you know, your spine then settles back in after you return to Earth. But you get a little bit of discomfort in the back. Man, the biggest change is in your head, in the vestibular system, which works on gravity, is not working in space. So it can induce nausea, space sickness. And when you come back, you're going through kind of a reverse of that, incorporating that vestibular data as well, which gives you your balance and your motion, your eye head movements, your eyes, you know, as you move your head, your eyes track. Like I can, in space, that gets all messed up because you don't have, you learn to do that without the vestibular inputs, and then you come back to Earth, and now you've got to learn how to integrate that as well.
Do you feel the same you did before you went into space? Right now, do you feel different?
I feel, you know, my experience, I think, have changed me, but physically, no.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I'm also a low vision person, so I have a question.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually, it's a four-part question. You've answered both.
All right.
I believe you said that you were something like 2350.
Did I? 2350, yep.
Okay, which is definitely, according to federal regulations, legally blind.
Well, that's uncorrected, though. I mean, I'm correctable to 2020.
Okay, so yeah. When you took that training, mm-hmm. I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, I'm not, let me be quite honest, let me be very honest with you. I'm correctable to 2020. I'm not a hazard on the streets, all right, or in the sky, or to my friends in the space shuttle. Correctable to 2020. No, I just want you to know, I want to be clear, because sometimes I say things I don't know what the hell came out of my mouth. I want to tell you the truth, I don't know what comes out of my mouth sometimes, but I'm correctable to 2020.
So through the process that you went through.
Ah.
To improve your vision, took you from, say, 2350 to 2020 with
glasses? No. The requirement we needed at NASA was 2150 uncorrected vision at that time. Now it's changed. I don't even know what it is now. It's way easier than that. But they had changed it from 2150 to 2200 uncorrected. So I had to get good enough to see 2200 uncorrected.
Oh, my God, that means I would have qualified. And the only other question.
Now you'd really be in, because now it's, I think it's like, I don't even know what it is, but it's beyond, well beyond that.
The only other question mm-hmm. I have is about the spinal elongation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the absence of gravity?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back,
it just settles back in. That's right. That's correct. The force comes back.
I'm a dancer, and that's of interest to me.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
Right, you bet.
Yeah.
Could you describe some of what makes an EVA so exhausting? It seems like you're floating, but mm-hmm. I hear from so many astronauts that it's just an ordeal, really. Like, what is it that makes it so exhausting and so difficult?
It depends on what you're doing. If you're on the, sometimes you're on the robot arm and you're getting moved around with the robot arm. And other times you're at a free floater. One person is, we call a free floater, and the other person is on the robot arm usually. If you're on the robot arm, it's a bit easier because you're getting moved around from place to place. But when you're free floating, especially, you're constantly moving. So you're constantly moving all the time. And it is zero gravity, but still you are moving a big suit around. And that suit, even in, it doesn't have any weight, but it still has mass. So you're controlling a suit with tools on it that is, you know, you might be a 200-pound person. Like, I mean, I'm a bigger astronaut, so I weigh about 200 pounds, right? The equipment I have on is about at least another 200 pounds on top of that. So I'm about a 450-pound mass, in, you know, moving around in space. And that mass still has momentum, which means as you're moving it around, you have to move around very carefully, and then you have to stop it. And so you're constantly, you know, using yourself to move, and although it might seem it is very, you want to be as light as you can, you have to, and you're moving against a suit, so it's pressurized, and it's pressurized at 4.3 psi, but that's against the vacuum, so you're always fighting against that pressure differential in the suit. So you're moving the suit, as you move the suit, you're fighting against that pressure. The part of your body that gets most exhausted is your hands, because that's where, you know, your muscles in your hand to move that glove, and you're going to use your hands a lot in a spacewalk. That's what gets the most tired. You have to be careful of. But by the time you're done with a spacewalk for 6.5 hours, you've had a really good workout, and you know, you've been pretty well moving the whole time. you need to, you know, it's important to have a good breakfast. Nutrition is really important, and you have the only thing you have for nutrition inside of the spacesuit is a 32-ounce drink bag to keep yourself hydrated. Yeah, so that's it. And I'm wondering why did I get so tired all the time? But you're fighting the suit. You're fighting the pressure in the suit. It's also can be mentally exhausting. You know, after 6 hours of constantly thinking about every little move, and needing to focus at your highest degree of concentration, you're pretty drained after 6, 7, 8 hours.
So you're saying they don't make you do the additional like 2.5 hours of daily training after you do an EVA?
No, when you're done, yeah, no, that's it. You know, and that was it. Yeah, there's no reason to go to the gym if you're in the pool that day, and no riding the exercise bike after an EVA. No, you're done for that day.
That moment, after all the hard work that you did, you're in the space shuttle, and you hit zero, and you're flying now. What's going on?
You know, when you first started moving, I knew the first thing I went through was we're really moving. I knew we were going. You know, I was like, oh, I wonder if we launch or not. You're really going, right? You, as soon as you go to hit the top of the launch tower, you're already over 100 miles an hour, and you go from zero to 17,500 miles an hour in 8.5 minutes. And I really thought something was wrong that very first launch. There was so much motion, particularly with the solid rockets when they kicked in, and they run kind of rough, and there's a lot of motion, a lot of violence on the way up, and I was just more or less praying the whole way up that first time, and just kind of hoping we were going to live through this experience, and we did. And then the second time, I tried to enjoy it a little bit more, you know, have the confidence we were going to be okay, knew what to expect, and then just tried to enjoy it more the second time. But the first time, I was like, I hope this is right. I hope this is what it's supposed to be like. And I also had the sense that a couple things happened to me. One was is that I had the sense of actually leaving. You know, I write about this in the book, that I had the sense of leaving home for the first time, being far away from the planet, really leaving home for the first time. And also that hopefully everything was going to work okay, because the power, the overall raw power of that vehicle made me feel like there was nothing I could really do to stop it. You know, and we had a lot of emergency procedures to work through, and if something were to go wrong. But none of those, we did them in simulations, but we never went to those abort cards for a real launch. Either it was a good day or a bad day. And I just had that sense as well, that either, you know, there's really nothing we're going to be able to do. If this thing decides that it's not going to be a big day, it's not going to be a good day, it's going to be a bad day, there's really nothing we're going to be able to do to fix that. So.
I have a two-parter. First, John Glenn famously went back into space at 75 or 76.
Mm-hmm.
When you reach that age, I should say, would that be something you'd be willing to do to expand the information on geriatrics in space?
Oh, I would do it, but I'm not John Glenn. They're not going to let me. John Glenn's has a different resume. You know, John Glenn is John Glenn. You know, with me, they're like, okay, it was nice having you, Mike. See you at the next reunion. I don't, John, that was different. He went into space for a number of reasons, but I think one of the biggest ones is that, you know, he was John Glenn. So, yeah, I don't think NASA will have me go back. I hope to go to space again, but.
Is that something you look at repeating or
no,
expanding that?
No. Absolutely not. No, John Glenn was a very unique case and a very unique person. And, no, they're not going to. I'd be shocked if they pull anybody out at age 75 to put them up there again. No.
Part two is, I know that NASA has facilities all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Do different things and specialize different things in Ohio, where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
They have the John Glenn.
That's right.
They call it used to be Lewis Research.
Right.
John Glenn. And then a little west, they have a place called Plumbrook.
Uh-huh.
Which has the large vacuum chamber.
Okay.
Have you had an opportunity to work or visit any of those?
Lewis. Well, we used to call it Lewis, but the Glenn Research Center, yes, but not the other place. No, not a but certainly, yeah, at the at
was there
Glenn.
There or?
We went there for a visit. A buddy of mine, my spacewalking buddy. Well, first of all, we visit every NASA center. Okay, when you first become an astronaut, you get to go to every NASA center to see what they do and meet people. So that was part of our initial training. And then after your flights, you go and visit NASA centers afterwards. There wasn't much for my space flights that was going on at the Glenn Research Center. Most of our stuff was in Houston, of course, where we lived and where we trained primarily. Also at the Kennedy Space Center, where we launched from, but also at Goddard. We would go to JPL every once in a while for something. Ames, they had a vertical simulator. We would go ride there, so I was there for my training as well. Huntsville, Alabama, went there a lot. You know, we went to Huntsville a lot. Did not go to Glenn all that much for my training, but again, when we first started, and then my buddy, Mike Good, who's very excited right now because he's a big Cleveland Indians fan. Did they win today?
No.
They lost, so they're up 3-1. Oh, I'm sorry. You guys are having a good year. I think it's Cleveland's year. You know, they had LeBron and...
About time.
All right, well, be grateful. I mean, this is going to be good, right? So I think Bueno's really excited. But he was from Cleveland, so we went there as part of our post-flight tour as well to Cleveland. So, yeah, a great place.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating place.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
What does it feel like coming back to Earth?
Coming back is interesting as well. You know, it's not the abrupt launch like we had going up. You don't come back right away, but you come back fairly quick. I mean, you come back, you do a deorbit burn on the other side of the planet, about 180 degrees out of where you want to land. And you start to slow down, and as you slow down, you drop into the atmosphere, and you slow down through friction, so you pick up a lot of heat. And outside of the spaceship, it starts to glow a bit. There's orange, red, hot temperature. You know, it's a few thousand degrees Fahrenheit out there as you're slowing down. And then you come below. You get down kind of into the atmosphere. You can't see very well out the windows. I had no sensation of speed while we were during this one phase because it looked like we were in a cloud. So I didn't feel like we were moving, and I didn't feel like we were going anywhere. But I looked at our instruments, and we were still going 12,000 miles an hour. But I didn't feel like we were moving at all. But you get below that, and then you can pick up the horizon again. You know, you can stick the horizon of the Earth. You know, and then you get lower and lower. And then I was on the mid deck for my first flight, so I didn't see anything out the windows. But my second flight, I was on a flight deck, and as we're coming in through, came into Edwards, into California, not too far from where we are here, and we could pick up the coast of California, and then you keep coming down, and you can see the landing field, you can see Edwards and the runways, and you come in for the landing, and then once you get on the ground, now you've got to undo all this wackiness that's been going on in your head of the vestibular system and the balance being off, and you've got to learn how to walk around again and manage your balance. And I felt like I was going to fall over when I first got back. But you want to be cool, right? So you got to get out. The tradition is you get out and you look at the spaceship, right? And you walk around, you point to it, and say, "Oh, look at that!" And you know it's just cool. Make sure everything's okay, right? So you want to do that. So you got to be able to walk around to do that. And I that was my goal, and I did that, but was very worried that I might fall over, and someone would videotape that and post it. But I didn't fall over, and I was able to get back okay.
When did your back start to hurt?
The back hurt a little bit when the spine elongated, and then it was fine after that. Yeah, me, my missions were on the shuttle, so 2 weeks at a time. Yeah. So a lot of the physiological issues that happen to people who are in space for a longer time is bigger issues that can happen, things like bone loss and muscle loss, and you have to exercise to counteract that. We still needed to exercise, but we wouldn't have been as bad a shape as some of my colleagues who've been on the space station for 6 months or longer. You have to make sure you do your exercise period. 6 out of 7 days it's scheduled. So
is it true that they stopwatch you until you pass out?
What's that?
I heard they hit a stopwatch until you pass out.
No. I never heard that. I hadn't even heard that one before. No, they don't want you to pass out because they don't blame the doctors. We did have an astronaut at a debrief at a press conference faint. And that was the last time they let us stand during a post-flight press conference. But yeah,
hey, one last question, and yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm Casey, your niece's very good friend. She says hi.
Where is she? She didn't make it here tonight.
Me in her place.
All right, thanks. What is your name?
Amber.
Amber, thank you for coming, Amber.
Thank you. I wanted to know if any of your sort of grand beliefs on life, why we exist, why we're here, anything sort of spiritual or your, any of your philosophies changed once you experience space.
You know, I'd like to bring you on this one too. And my, how about I give my answer? You give yours from. Do you mind?
Yeah, no.
All right, so,
yeah, do you want to go first?
I'll go first and say that I think that I think our planet is wonderful, and I don't think we have anything like it anywhere close. But I do believe that there is life other places. I think the possibilities are too great that we're the only ones around. And I'll turn this one over to Bob. I can see what.
I mean, so I totally agree. I don't. As we learn more about our own solar system. And with Kepler and Hubble and everything else, we can see other star systems, see planets, potentially planets that would have liquid water. We are realizing, one, that there's a ton of places in our own solar system for life to potentially exist. And now, you know, we're multiplying that by, I think it's 2 trillion galaxies that Hubble has basically determined roughly. Hubble has about 2 trillion galaxies.
That's a lot of galaxies. Because each one of those galaxies has... How many stars? Like
hundreds of millions. Yeah, hundreds of millions of stars.
Hundreds of millions of stars and 2 trillion. That's a lot of stars.
We have, you know, Kepler has about 4,000 planets in a very small, actually relatively empty part of our Milky Way. So it seems really likely to me that we have life somewhere else. There's all sorts of reasons for why it might not contact us, or it may be physically, you know, nearly impossible. I mean, remember, one of the amazing things about Hubble is it can literally look back 12 billion years, 13 billion years. So some of the things that we're seeing, you know, are not at all what they look like to us. They are, that is basically a time machine looking back, you know, at a star as it existed 13 billion years ago and no longer exists. But it is absolutely amazing. I mean, the pictures are amazing. The science has been amazing. So I have no doubt of that. I think that just looking back, I think one of the amazing things that we get to do at this time is try to put a context on our own existence. So I think that, you know, humans looking down on Earth, I think the robots looking back at Earth, or even trying to understand what are the odds that this happens every so often. I think we're really lucky to be able to kind of start to answer this question. I don't think it's going to be over in our lifetimes. There's many more. But we're kind of at this amazing time where I think we'll get to at least understand our solar system. And then, you know, future generations will be able to explore other star systems. But at least, you know, it's a pretty good time. I definitely think, like, if you're a space history buff 1,000 years from now, you're going to be like, wow, what was it like to be there in the 2000, you know, 2000s when they were first sending people, you know, beyond lunar orbit and to Mars and, you know, robots out to the edge of the solar system. I think that's going to be pretty awesome.
Are they not contacting us because we're the smartest?
Well,
yeah.
There's a ton of reasons, right? I mean, you could just imagine, we're going to have a whole separate Q&A about this, but, you know, just we are at an interesting cusp on our own, right? We have the technological power to destroy ourselves, which is possible for things. We also have the ability now with virtual reality to exist and never need to travel or want to travel. That could happen routinely. We just have no clue, right? This is, I mean, what's amazing about what Mike's describing as this planet is it's the only data. If you are a scientist and you are like, I want to understand the trend of things, we have one data point for all of life. Like, we know that the laws of physics apply at, you know, distant planets and distant stars. We know chemistry works out there. We just have no clue about biology. Biology is like the one of the hard sciences that is just, it's all based on this, you know, the single ball in space. And so we're trying to answer those questions with our robotic exploration and human exploration, but, you know. Very well.
I close my eyes. The little information I have, you know, it keeps me up at night. I have all these computers and all, I couldn't sleep.
I feel happy knowing that I get to help answer those questions, even if it's not done by the time I'm done. Anyway, you guys should get your book signed.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
Bobic, thank you very much. Really fun doing this with you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.